This is the Medicast, July 21st, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast. This is episode 127. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. As the summer continues to move along here in my area and a lot of other things are going on, it's been a very busy summertime for me with running around with my kids and getting a lot of things done and also finishing up my nursing school requirements. I graduated, of course, but still working on finishing up getting my nursing boards, my NCLEX exams done. I actually took the exam, waiting to hear my results, so hopefully we'll hear back on that very soon. But I've been very busy and certainly have not been blogging very much. If you've been over to the website, you may have noticed that there haven't been quite as many posts as there have been in past weeks. Apologize for that and working on improving that in the coming weeks. So you want to make sure you check out the website at medicast.com and the Medicast blog at medicast.com/blog for articles, posts, and of course the show notes and links from every single episode. I want to thank all of the loyal listeners to the show, and especially all of those brand new listeners who aren't loyal listeners yet, but I know soon will be. I want to welcome you to the show and remind you that there's lots of information available for you over at the Medicast site, including access to the Medicast newsletter and all of the other things, including the Medicast forums. So you can find out a whole lot more over there, and I urge you to do so. If you're a longtime listener and you'd like to contribute something back to the show, we have a lot of new students that'll be coming on looking for medical podcasts and EMS podcasts. So if you haven't done so already and you'd like to share a review of the Medicast over at the iTunes store or some other podcasting forum, you can always go over and do that. And you can find that by going to the iTunes store, and then just typing in Medicast into the search field. And go over and leave a review. There's about 19 reviews over there now. It'd be great to have some other reviews show up over the coming weeks. So if you haven't done so and you're sitting down with your computer at some point, take a few moments and let other folks know what it is you like about the Medicast, some of the things that you find good and helpful about the Medicast, so that someone else shopping around for a podcast out there will use your review to help them decide if the Medicast is for them. One way a lot of people get in touch with the show is via email, and I got some good listener emails in this week. One from listener Jesse in South Dakota, and Jesse's an EMTP from South Dakota, and Jesse sent in a link to an article about a hospital in South Dakota that was actually involved in the security there tasering a patient in the emergency department. And certainly an interesting article. Jesse, thanks for the read information and the link there. I always appreciate it. You know, if you see something crop up in your searches of the news online, and don't just assume I found it, you can always send me an email at podmedic@mac.com with a link to the particular articles. It may not make it into the news that week, but it's certainly good for me to go ahead and read all of that information, and I really appreciate it. So Jesse, thanks a lot for sending me that email, and keep in touch and let me know how things are in EMS in South Dakota. I also got an email from listener Brian, who ordered himself a Medicast t-shirt and water bottle from the Medicast store. And I hope, Brian, that you enjoy those. They should have gone off in the mail to you. And if you haven't received them, you'll be receiving them soon. And, you know, I was thinking as I got this email from Brian with his order for the Medicast store that, you know, would be great if we had access to some pictures of people wearing their Medicast t-shirts or sporting their Medicast gear in front of their station or in front of their ambulance, and just kind of showing off the Medicast from different areas of the world. You know, the Medicast listeners are listened to worldwide, and I think it would be great to use the forums and the posts over there to post up your pictures of you guys with your Medicast t-shirts and your Medicast water bottles and whatnot. So, you know, I urge you, if you are also like some of the listeners that ordered stuff in the past weeks, if you'd like to go over and take a picture of yourself wearing your Medicast t-shirt, that would be great. And then you can head over to forums.medicast.com and post that picture up on the Medicast forums. There's pictures on the front page there and also areas for videos as well. So great way to participate in the community and show off where you listen to the Medicast. And I certainly appreciate it. And Brian, thanks for your order. I also got a lot of positive responses from a number of listeners on last week's segment with Lisa Booz on acetaminophen overdoses. Lisa and I really enjoyed putting together these segments, and I'm looking forward to a long time partnership where we can provide many more of these poison control tips for the medical professions. And I think it's a great opportunity for the rest of us to remind ourselves of the resources available in our local poison control. And I got some emails from many listeners about just that, that they it helped remind them that poison control was available for them. So I want to thank you all for the comments. Too many to really list here, but I want to thank you. Also, I want to thank Lisa again for taking the time to provide the Medicast community with her expertise in poison control. And of course, Maryland Poison Control as well for letting Lisa be available to do that. And if you want to find out more or even subscribe to the Maryland Poison Control Talks Tidbit email newsletter, you can actually do that whether you're in the state of Maryland or not. Just go to mdpoison.com and you'll find links on the front page there to go ahead and sign up for the email newsletter, and you can download that. It comes in a PDF, generally on one page, so that you can actually print it out and post it at your station. It's a great way to get information on different toxicology subjects out there in your station house and provide some additional educational reading while people are standing around waiting for the next call. Let's jump on into the news this week, and I'm going to start off with a story that has a little bit to do with what I was talking about with our friend Paul Bond. What if you're a paramedic that wants to move into the nursing setting? What if you're tired of working out on the streets for long hours and not a whole lot of money, and you'd like to take advantage of some of the great pay increases being offered to people in the nursing profession? What are you going to do? How do you handle that? Well, some areas are really adopting a great process of taking paramedics and bridging them to become RNs using a combination of online and classroom-based education to take advantage of the knowledge base the paramedics already have and the vast amounts of actual clinical experience paramedics already have, and taking that and applying that knowledge to the learning needed to become a nurse. And this is something that was not available when I started making the transition into nursing, but it's certainly something that is becoming increasingly available now. In fact, it's something that I've been asked to participate in looking at doing in our own local community college and finding a way to bridge their existing nursing curriculum into such a way that they can apply it and bring paramedics in somewhere along that path. And it's exciting to do. It's exciting to look at. I found a great article on just this from El Paso, Texas, looking at the shortage of nurses there and how the community college there started a special program and bridged paramedics to registered nurses. Now, this is the first year of the program. They have a class of 27 students, and they have a significant amount of scholarship money available for this initial class to get it kickstarted, to get it moving along. And this is for paramedics that have been in the field, have a lot of experience, and want to take that knowledge and take it and learn the new information needed to make them good nurses. And while there are a lot of things about nursing and being a paramedic that are the same, there are a lot of things that are different and a lot of additional information that is needed to be a good nurse. And so these bridge programs are springing up and they're adopting different ways to handle the strange schedules that EMS providers work. And it's going to be interesting to see how this develops in other regions as well. But I urge you to read the article. It's a great look at how these programs may be adapted in your region, perhaps, and something you can always talk about to your local training facilities, your local community colleges and colleges, about whether they'd be interested in looking at putting together a paramedic bridge program for themselves. Next up is a news item from my own backyard. The governor of Maryland has announced that they will be funding a new communications interoperability program that will be put in place over the coming months and next few years. And basically, this executive order will establish a statewide communication system allowing law enforcement, EMS, and other public safety personnel from different state, county, and municipal agencies to use one emergency single radio system to talk to each other. And this is something that has been put out there and almost mandated by the federal government following the communications issues seen in the 9/11 disaster and attacks. And certainly something that we saw again when Katrina happened, where agencies couldn't effectively communicate with each other. Certainly, good communication is the foundation of dealing with any emergency. If we can't talk to each other and formulate a plan and then put that plan into effect and respond to changes needed to adapt a plan to a given situation, then those plans just aren't going to work or not work as effectively as they could. Communications is really a huge part of this picture, and it's really good to see that Maryland has taken a proactive step to putting this program in place. Now, I know in my county, we just put a whole new radio system in place, and one of the things that our local emergency services director is saying is that he hopes that their system is going to be compatible with the one we just put in. Otherwise, it's going to be a lot of wasted money that was spent putting a new system in place. Now, he's hopeful that based on the way the system was put in place in our county, that it's pretty interoperable with other systems and that things can be bridged and patched together pretty well with neighboring jurisdictions. He's hoping that the state of Maryland interoperability program will use a similar system to allow communication systems to be patched together and talk to each other. But of course, we need individual units and radios to be able to talk to each other as well. And that's certainly just as important. So we'll have to see how this shakes out. And I'm wondering if there are similar initiatives in place or on the books in your communities, in your jurisdictions, in your states. How are you communicating with other agencies in your region? Is this something that has been addressed? Is it something that has been put out there and then decided it costs too much money? What are you looking at in your area? I'd love to hear back from you. And I know this is a topic of strong consideration with people like Rick Rosati, who deal with national incident management problems and disaster planning. And, you know, Rick's Mitigation Journal podcast, he talks about communications all the time. So something we hope to see more and more in jurisdictions across the country, being able to talk with each other. And of course, not just state within each state, but between the different agencies in different states. So we'll have to see how that works out. Moving right along, let's jump on in and look at the next article. And this comes out of EMSresponder.com from an article out of Boston, Massachusetts. And they are looking at a problem reported by their poison control center in Massachusetts on the number of caffeine-related overdoses calls and the caffeine poisonings and calls to the poison control centers. This was something they looked into and found that the most recent data from 2005 shows 4,600 caffeine-related calls to poison control centers nationwide in the year 2005, mostly involving patients under the age of 19. Now, a lot of times these were involving things like energy drinks and some of the other over-the-counter herbal remedies out there that have a lot of caffeine in them for use by a lot of people. And they found that this was an increasingly potent problem in the communities. They said that energy drinks, also aggressively marketed caffeine-packed beverages of other varieties sold in every convenience store and grocery store, is some of the things that are causing this problem. They also talk about other situations where caffeine is ingested, and a lot of these calls are coming in from school nurses in high schools and in college settings where people are having side effects from these energy drinks. And it's something that people need to be aware of. You know, caffeine is a central nervous system stimulant, and it's going to have effects like increasing agitation, causing tremors, causing heart palpitations. And these things are not uncommonly seen when you take too much caffeine. The article points out that because companies don't have to report on the dosing of the caffeine, the levels of caffeine present in a given item, that there is no way to monitor how much caffeine you're getting. Some items of caffeinated beverages like Red Bull don't have a whole lot more than a strong cup of coffee, but there are other drinks out there that have two, three, four times as much caffeine present in the beverage. And even though the beverage container may contain multiple servings and the serving size, we all know that when you buy a large bottle of something, generally you consume it as a single serving, whether it's supposed to be two servings or not. Also, there are other forms of caffeine showing up on the marketplace, including caffeine-infused items like gum, lip balm, and also caffeinated versions of snack foods. This is something that could be of concern, as people may not be aware of the additional caffeine in the snack food. They're drinking an energy drink with it, and they may begin to have problems like sweats, uncontrollable nausea and vomiting, headaches. Severe complications are also capable and could happen, like tachycardias and tachyarrhythmias. These are all very serious problems, and we should be well aware of this in the emergency setting. Something to keep in mind, you ought to check the article out for yourself. I have a link in the show notes, and you can head over and check it out at emsresponder.com. Finally, I will wrap up the news this week with a look at another story coming out of the emsresponder.com site. And this is a report that is on a study conducted by some physicians on whether patients understood their discharge instructions when they left the hospital. This is from the Annals of Emergency Medicine, and the article is entitled Patient Comprehension of Emergency Department Care and Instructions. Are patients aware of when they don't understand? And this is a key point, because I think if a patient doesn't understand their discharge instructions, if they don't follow these instructions and get the necessary care or take the medications or perform follow-up care the way they need to, guess what happens when they have a problem? That's right. They call 911 and they have an ambulance come and pick them up. And so we end up picking up these patients who were recently seen in the emergency department and taking them back to have some additional explanations performed, perhaps some additional care performed, so that they can get the care that they should have gotten the first time around. And they may have indeed gotten that care, but failed to understand their part in following up when they got home. So what does this mean for us in the EMS field? Well, it means that we can take additional steps when we respond to situations that we have patients that have recently been seen in the hospital. We need to ask for copies of their discharge instructions. We need to ask them questions about what they understood or didn't understand about their discharge instructions. And we need to relay that information respectfully to the emergency department when we bring them back. And I don't mean that we get in there and say, well, you didn't tell them what they needed to know, so they screwed up their care when they got home and had to call us. That's not what I'm saying. I will never, ever tell you to be disrespectful to another medical personnel, medical provider of any kind. Just like I don't expect you to be treated disrespectfully by other medical personnel. But there is a way that we can do this. A lot of times, the physicians and nurses aren't aware that the patients didn't hear them clearly. They're very rushed trying to get patients out of the ER so they can make room for the next ones we're bringing in. And we like it when there are beds available, right? So we need to work together as a team. And if all that's needed is some re-education for these patients, sometimes the emergency department can more rapidly get them processed. And if we can ascertain that in the field, if we have their paperwork with us and bring it in with them when they come back to the hospital, sometimes we can point out where the lack of communication occurred. You know, they got home and they weren't sure whether they were supposed to change the dressing or not. And even though you told them not to change the dressing, they went ahead and changed it anyway. And they had severe bleeding start all over again. And we had to come in and help them out. So that's an, you know, understandable mistake. But it means, it just points out to the nurse and to the physicians, you know what, we just need to remind them a little bit more strongly the next time. We need to be a little more careful in passing along information to patients, making sure they understand their instructions. And this is something where we are part of a team, and that team approach can alleviate the problem by working together, by pointing out when there are points in the system where the ball is getting dropped, and we can go ahead and help fill that gap, help point out where there needs to be a little bit of a change, and help the other parts of the system shore up their end. You know, we make mistakes too, and we like it when people help us fix and get around our errors. And certainly we can do the same thing for them, because when the ER is happy, we're happy, and vice versa. For the tip of the week this week, I thought we would look at some of the pharmacology that we need to have a handle on. And one of those things is how the medications actually get into the body, the routes of administration. Now, we've talked about some of these things before. When we review each medication, we talk a little bit about the medications. But some of the things that we do, we may not understand exactly why. Why do we give meds in the way that we do? How do we determine that the best way to administer a medication is via one route versus another? And so it's important for us to understand the differences between the routes of administration, and also some of the things that we need to understand about what's important when we give medications via certain routes. So we're going to talk a little bit about those topics, as well as covering each of the routes of administration individually. Now, one of the things that governs the routes of administration in certain medications is the concept of pharmacokinetics. And this is how the medication is absorbed into the body. And different routes of administration are absorbed in different ways, whether it's through the capillary networks in the linings and the muscle tissue in an intramuscular injection, or the mucosal lining of a sublingual administration of a medication, the rectal lining. There's a lot of different ways that medications can be absorbed, and how they are absorbed in that particular location, how much of the medication is absorbed, the way the medication is then transported into the bloodstream and onto the target tissue, is all part of the grand picture of pharmacokinetics. The kinetics, you can think of kinetic energy, the energy of movement. This is the movement of medication once it's administered or introduced to the body. What happens, how it is moved to the target tissue. What it does once it gets to the target tissue is the pharmacodynamics. And of course, you need to have a therapeutic dose of the medication reach the target tissue, or the medication is not going to be effective. So it's important to understand how to administer the medication carefully and safely via certain routes, and then understand how those routes of administration break down the medication. 100% of a medication does not reach the target tissue in most all cases of administration of a medication. In fact, significant amounts of a medication are broken down before they even reach target tissues, and that is something to understand as well in certain medications, because you're going to have to administer them carefully in carefully measured doses to make sure that the significant amount of the medication needed reaches the target area. So there are two basic routes of administration, two basic ways that medication gets into the body, via the enteral route, and that is the GI tract, and that starts at the mouth and goes all the way to the anus, and that the continuous tube of our gastrointestinal system is one of the ways that medications are administered. And we think about this in pill form. One example would be aspirin is a form of oral administration, an enteral administration. The oral route, you take aspirin, chew it up, swallow it, and it is absorbed into the GI tract. Another thing would be activated charcoal or perhaps oral glucose, all administered via this route of enteral administration. Sublingual nitroglycerin as well, all the enteral route. Rectal administration of diazepam is an enteral route because it is being administered to the GI tract from the other direction. And not something we always think about, but there is a possibility for that. In a hospital environment, suppositories are given sometimes to give medications and have it absorbed through the mucosal lining in the rectum into the capillary system and into the bloodstream that way. So something to think about. That is one way. By far, though, most of the time in EMS, at least at the ALS level, or when we think about medications sometimes, especially in emergency situations, we need to get medications rapidly into the body. And many times the enteral route is not the most rapid way to administer medications. These medications need to be absorbed rapidly, and the fastest way is to get the medication directly into the bloodstream, the intravenous route. But there are other ways to do this as well. And this is the parenteral route, the outside of the GI tract route. And the parenteral routes are various and include any point along the body, including injections, transdermal patches, pace, intranasal administration. All of this could be included in this particular category. So the parenteral routes of administration include intradermal administration, and this is the most commonly used for administration of testing, things like allergy testing, where they administer allergens just under the skin to see if there's a reaction in small amounts, and they test different areas of the skin for different things. Also, you'll see this like in the tuberculin test, where they're testing to see if you have been exposed to tuberculosis and have developed antibodies to tuberculosis. That would be another way that this is used. Not often used in general medication administration, most often used for testing. Then there is transdermal administration. Transdermal is, you'll see frequently in the field, people wearing nitro patches, people who are wearing some kind of pain relief analgesic patch. Duragesic patches are most commonly seen in the field by an EMS personnel, although other transdermal medications are becoming available and may become more common because it is easy to apply and you don't have to remember to take medications very frequently because you can wear a patch for several days in some cases. This is also used in the ALS sector and in hospital setting when nitro paste is administered. This is where you put a section of paste on a piece of special prepared paper and apply it to the chest, and it is absorbed through the skin into the body that way and is slowly administered. Because it's administered and absorbed slowly through the skin, you can administer nitro paste and have it slowly be released and absorbed into the body over time, and it gives you a longer acting effect than you would get from the sublingual administration of nitroglycerin, which only lasts 5 to 10 minutes, and you need to readminister it frequently in the cases of patients that need it. This is a good way to administer these medications before they are able to get access to something like a nitro drip in the hospital. So we've talked about the surface of the skin. Let's move down below that into the subcutaneous level. Subcutaneous level refers to that layer of fat just below the layers of the skin, and the subcutaneous fat actually slows absorption. So when you inject medications into this fatty area of the body, there is a delayed effect. It is a time release. So you're going to have a prolonged reaction to the medication, prolonged effect of the medication as it's slowly absorbed by the limited capillary tissue present in that fatty area. And as it's absorbed and released into the body, you can move on and do other things. You'll see this a lot of times in insulin administration. You'll also see it in the EMS field, most commonly with subcutaneous injection of epinephrine for things like allergic reactions. And this is where you come into subcutaneous injections. You're going to inject like 45-degree angle. You're not going straight into the muscle tissue. You want to come in at a 45-degree angle under the skin and above the muscle and use a relatively short needle to do that. You also then have intramuscular. We go even deeper. You get it into the muscle tissue. This is a very common route of administration. You'll use often with administration of injectable analgesic medications. It's injected directly into the muscle tissue and absorbed pretty rapidly into the bloodstream from the muscle. The muscle is very vascular, and so you get that in there. You'll also see intramuscular injections of vaccines as well, and because those vaccines sometimes react with the tissues around it, that's why your muscles become sore, because you've kind of caused a localized reaction in the muscle tissue. And intramuscular is slower than IV, but faster than subcutaneous administration as far as the pharmacokinetics go. But it is a very common form of administration, and we'll see this in things like administration of things like Haldol for chemical restraint purposes. Other medications are administered IM as well. But something to keep in mind and be aware of, that it is less rapidly absorbed than IV, but more rapidly absorbed than subcutaneous administration. So again, it's going to be quickly absorbed and will also be more quickly out of the system and used up as well. So you may need to administer follow-up dosing within 15 minutes to a half an hour if you have administered something IM. Again, each medication is absorbed differently, so you need to follow up on that as far as when next administration may be anticipated. IV or intravenous administration of a medication is next on our list as we delve down from the skin to the depths of the body and routes of administration. IV administration is a very rapid and very easily predicted response to a medication. It's taken into the bloodstream, rapidly transported throughout the body to target tissues, and so you see signs of its effects very quickly. Negatively, you also see side effects very quickly. And so this is where you need to be very aware of danger signs, of dangerous side effects, dangerous reactions to medications, and be prepared to take care of those side effects, either discontinuing the administration if it's a drip, or preparing an antidote if there is one to a medication that you may be administering. For instance, if you're administering morphine for pain and the patient's respiratory signs rapidly decrease, you're going to need to be prepared to administer IV Narcan to raise back up and remove that side effect. And of course, you're also removing the effects of the medication too. But again, IV administration, very rapid signs of side effects too, and is very common in the emergency sectors because of the fact that it's a quick and rapid way to get medications into the bloodstream and to target tissues in emergency situations. Now, if you don't have IV access, what else do we have that can get rapidly into the bloodstream? Well, we have IO access, and IO access is something that's becoming quite a buzzword in many areas of medicine, primarily because of the advent of the IO drills, these handheld battery-operated drills that are able to get intraosseous access, access to the marrow spaces of the bone quickly and relatively easily, so that we can administer medications that are almost going to be as rapidly absorbed as IV medications through the very vascular space at the center of the bone. This is also needs to be carefully observed. Some medications can't be administered intraosseously because they may have some caustic effects and may adversely affect the bone. So it's something to be aware of. If you have a medication that can be administered IO, you want to make sure you understand side effects here as well, and especially side effects that may be specifically related to intraosseous administration. Other parenteral routes include inhalation. This is the aerosolized medications that we see, albuterol, Atrovent, those medications that are absorbed directly into the lungs via inhalation and then sent to their target tissues through absorption through the alveoli into the tissues. And this is not just for respiratory medications. Some medications have been administered in this form for other areas of the body. There have been inhalation versions of insulin brought into the marketplace. And so this is a very effective and efficient way to administer some medications via the mucosal lining of the respiratory tract. Also, there are rarely things like sublingual injections. Also, injections into specific organ areas, intracardiac injections, for instance, injections directly into areas of organs for purposes of biopsy or other forms. But those are rare and not often seen in emergency sectors or in general practice in most areas of facilities. That's more of a specialized administration medication route. Again, just a quick review of the enteral routes includes sublingual administration, things like sublingual nitroglycerin tablets or sprays. Other sublingual medication routes may include the oral mucosal absorption of oral glucose, but that is also considered an oral administration because it can be swallowed and absorbed through the GI tract. And, of course, rectal administration, which is the absorption of a medication through the rectal mucosa, the mucosal lining of the rectum, and directly into the capillary beds in that way as well. And so between the enteral and the parenteral routes, you have the routes of administration for different medications. And understanding the pharmacokinetics involved with each route, as I've outlined briefly here, can give you an idea of how rapidly to expect to see the effects of a medication, and also how strongly you may see side effects to these medications, because rapid absorption will also include rapid signs of side effects as well. And that's a quick overview of routes of administration here on the tip of the week. For today's Med of the Week, I thought I'd look at epinephrine, and specifically the BLS epinephrine auto-injector. This is the medication that would be administered if a patient had a history of anaphylaxis or a history of severe allergic reactions to a given substance or allergen. These patients would have a prescribed auto-injector with them and would require assistance or actual injection from the auto-injector of the epinephrine. Now, of course, the indications for use of epinephrine in this particular situation include severe allergic reaction with respiratory distress or mild allergic reaction in patients with a history of a life-threatening allergic or an anaphylactic reaction. Also, some patients with severe asthma may also have prescribed auto-injectors as well. Some of the side effects you're likely to see from epinephrine administration include tachycardia, palpitations, angina, headache, nausea and vomiting, dizziness, hypertension, nervousness or anxiety, and general tremors. And you have to think about the effects of this medication. This is a medication that heightens the effects of the sympathetic nervous system response, that fight or flight response. And so you're going to have more epinephrine in the body. It's going to increase the heart rate. It's going to increase the respiratory rate. It's going to generally increase the body's preparedness to run and get away from a dangerous situation. And so think about those side effects that you might see in these patients. For patients that have a cardiac history, this could be detrimental to them because you're going to increase the workload on the heart by increasing heart rate, increasing contractility of the heart, increasing the workload on the heart. So you need to understand perhaps some of the underlying history. However, in the presence of a severe allergic reaction or impending anaphylaxis, there would not be a contraindication to administering this medication. Certain precautions need to be aware of, including, as I said, cardiac patients, but also pregnant patients, as this increased workload on the heart may decrease the amount of oxygen available to flow to an unborn fetus, and something to be aware of. Now, generally, preparations seen in these auto-injectors are 0.3 milligrams in the adult dose and in the pediatric dose, 0.15 milligrams. Now, commonly, these are seen as pediatric patients are anyone younger than 3 years of age get the decreased dose. And these are using the Maryland protocols for the BLS auto-injector. Anyone older than 3 years, their body size is large enough that the smaller dose will really not have much effect, and it is indicated to give them the full adult dose of 0.3 milligrams IM intramuscular injection via the auto injector. And that is exactly how that would be administered. Additional doses can be administered usually with medical consultation first. So you'll need to check in with medical control. And sometimes these patients have multiple auto injectors available to them, and you may be able to indeed administer these as well to them. In some cases, units carry the auto injectors on board themselves and have the ability under protocol to administer an auto injector even to someone who is not have it prescribed to them. So you need to follow your local protocols to determine whether or not you're allowed to use an auto injector on a patient to whom it is not directly prescribed to, as you would in some other medications in the BLS setting where you're using the patient's own medication to administer. Don't forget when administering this medication that the plunger, the soft rubber tip that you're going to press against the person's leg to administer the injection, is spring-loaded. And if you were to touch that end with your own body part, you could administer the injection to yourself. So you need to be careful. Treat it as a loaded weapon. You want to hold it securely in your fist. You're going to have to take the safety cap off the end. You're not going to put your thumb over the end of it. You're going to hold it in your fist with your thumb over your fingers with the open end available and then the injector end below your hand. You're going to then take it and press firmly against the person's leg. Hold it in place for a slow count of 10 to make sure the administration has been administered, and then you're going to remove it and rapidly put the auto injector in a Sharps container. Okay, it is a sharp. It needs to be put into a Sharps container rapidly. You can also rub the area where the injection has gone in to facilitate absorption via the intramuscular route. This is going to be a painful injection. It's a pretty good size needle and it's spring loaded, so it's going to go in pretty rapidly. Again, you want to make sure you're handling this appropriately and protecting yourself from the patient who may not react well to having that instant stabbing sensation. So you want to make sure that you're aware of the patient, that they're prepared for it, that you know what's going on in an adult patient so that you can administer this medication safely. But that's a quick overview and a look at the epinephrine auto-injector, the use of epinephrine, indications, contraindications, and doses of epinephrine in the BLS setting. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show and remind everybody to head over to MedicCast.com/blog for the MedicCast blog and show notes pages. And there will be additional articles and news items posted up throughout the course of this week and the coming weeks on different news and topical areas. I also want to remind you that you can get back in touch with me directly here at the MedicCast by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also call me on the MedicCast voicemail line, and that's a great way for you to get in touch with me as well, and also to share your voice with the listeners here on the show. Call in to 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. I'd love to hear from you on the voicemail line, and when you call in, don't forget to leave your email address at the very end. I'll clip it off, but that way, if I have any follow-up questions or need clarification, I can get in touch with you via email as well. Time for me to wrap up the show, and I will close out, as I always do, by sending you off with some great PodSafe music. This is an artist you've all heard here before, if you've been listening for a while, our good friend Matthew Ebel. And Matthew has penned a song called Wasting My Time. Sometimes I know we feel like we're wasting our time. Well, here's Matthew's take on that. I've played this song before. It's one of my favorites of his, and I hope you like it as well. Until the next time I speak with you, I want to remind you all that I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and also remind you all to remember, scene safety, BSI.
How can you love me when you don't know who I am? Got a lot more feeling from a bloodstained, dirty hand. And all I know is I was blind and the view looked mighty grand. I've been a white devil.
time again and again. I get so used to these crimes, but it wears kind of thin. I won't keep wasting my skin.